The Moving Finger by Agatha Christie. Read by James Saxon. Chapter 1. When at last I was taken out of the plaster, and the doctors had pulled me about to their heart's content, and nurses had wheedled me into cautiously using my limbs, and I had been nauseated by their practically using baby talk to me, Marcus Kent told me I was to go and live in the country. Good air, quiet life, nothing to do. That's the prescription for you. That sister of yours will look after you. Eat, sleep, and imitate the vegetable kingdom as far as possible. I didn't ask him if I'd ever be able to fly again. There are questions that you don't ask because you're afraid of the answers to them. In the same way, during the last 5 months, I'd never asked if I was going to be condemned to lie on my back all my life. I was afraid of a bright, hypocritical reassurance from sister. Come now, what a question to ask. We don't let our patients go talking in that way. So I hadn't asked. And it had been all right. I wasn't to be a helpless cripple. I could move my legs, stand on them, finally walk a few steps, and if I did feel rather like an adventurous baby learning to toddle, with wobbly knees and cotton-wool soles to my feet, well, that was only weakness and disuse and would pass. Marcus Kent, who is the right kind of doctor, answered what I hadn't said. "You're going to recover completely," he said. "We weren't sure until last Tuesday when you had that final overhaul, but I can tell you so authoritatively now. But it's going to be a long business. A long and, if I may say so, a wearisome business. When it's a question of healing nerves and muscles, the brain must help the body. Any impatience, any fretting, will throw you back. And whatever you do, don't will yourself to get well quickly. Anything of that kind, and you'll find yourself back in a nursing home. You've got to take life slowly and easily. The tempo is marked legato. Not only has your body got to recover, but your nerves have been weakened by the necessity of keeping you under drugs for so long. That's why I say, go down to the country, take a house, get interested in local politics, in local scandal, in village gossip. Take an inquisitive and violent interest in your neighbours. If I may make a suggestion, go to a part of the world where you haven't got any friends scattered about." I nodded. I had already, I said, thought of that. I could think of nothing more insufferable than members of one's own gang dropping in, full of sympathy and their own affairs. "But Jerry, you're looking marvellous, isn't he?" "Absolutely. Darling, I must tell you, what do you think Buster has done now?" "No. None of that for me. Dogs are wise. They crawl away into a quiet corner and lick their wounds and do not rejoin the world until they are whole once more." So it came about that Joanna and I, sorting wildly through house agents' glowing eulogies of properties all over the British Isles, selected Little Furze, Limstock, as one of the possibles to be viewed, mainly because we'd never been to Limstock and knew no one in that neighbourhood. And when Joanna saw Little Furze, she decided at once that it was just the house we wanted. It lay about half a mile out of Limstock on the road leading up to the moors. It was a prim, low, white house, with a sloping Victorian veranda painted a faded green. It had a pleasant view over a slope of heather-covered land with the church spire of Limstock down below to the left. It had belonged to a family of maiden ladies, the Misses Barton, of whom only one was left, the youngest, Miss Emily. Miss Emily Barton was a charming little old lady who matched her house in an incredible way. In a soft, apologetic voice, she explained to Joanna that she had never let her house before, indeed would never have thought of doing so. "But you see, my dear, things are so different nowadays. Taxation, of course, and then my stocks and shares, so safe, as I always imagined, and indeed the bank manager himself recommended some of them, but they seem to be paying nothing at all these days. Foreign, of course, and really it makes it all so difficult. One does not, I'm sure you will understand me, my dear, and not take offence, you look so kind, like the idea of letting one's house to strangers. But something must be done, and really, having seen you, I shall be quite glad to think of you being here. It needs, you know, young life. And I must confess I did shrink from the idea of having men here. At this point, Joanna had to break the news of me. Miss Emily rallied well.
Oh dear, I see. How sad. A flying accident. So brave, these young men. Still, your brother will be practically an invalid.
The thought seemed to soothe the gentle little lady. Presumably I should not be indulging in those grosser masculine activities which Emily Barton feared. She inquired diffidently if I smoked. Like a chimney, said Joanna. But then, she pointed out, so do I.
Of course, so stupid of me. I'm afraid, you know, I haven't moved with the times. My sisters were all older than myself, and my dear mother lived to be 97, just fancy, and was most particular. Yes, yes, everyone smokes now. The only thing is, there are no ashtrays in the house.
Joanna said that we would bring lots of ashtrays, and she added with a smile, we won't put down cigarette ends on your nice furniture, that I do promise you. Nothing makes me so mad myself as to see people do that. So it was settled, and we took Little Furs for a period of 6 months, with an option of another three, and Emily Barton explained to Joanna that she herself was going to be very comfortable because she was going into rooms kept by an old parlour-maid, my faithful Florence, who had married after being with us for 15 years. Such a nice girl, and her husband is in the building trade. They have a nice house in the High Street, and two beautiful rooms on the top floor, where I shall be most comfortable, and Florence so pleased to have me. So, everything seemed to be most satisfactory, and the agreement was signed, and in due course Joanna and I arrived and settled in, and Miss Emily Barton's maid, Partridge, having consented to remain, we were well looked after with the assistance of a girl who came in every morning, and who seemed to be half-witted, but amiable. Partridge, a gaunt, dour female of middle age, cooked admirably, and though disapproving of late dinner, it having been Miss Emily's custom to dine lightly off a boiled egg, nevertheless accommodated herself to our ways, and went so far as to admit that she could see I needed my strength building up. When we had settled in and been at Little Furs a week, Miss Emily Barton came solemnly and left cards. Her example was followed by Mrs. Symington, the lawyer's wife, Miss Griffith, the doctor's sister, Mrs. Dane Calthrop, the vicar's wife, and Mr. Pye of Prior's End. Joanna was very much impressed.
I didn't know, she said in an awestruck voice, that people really called with cards.
That is because, my child, I said, you know nothing about the country.
Nonsense! I've stayed away for heaps of weekends with people.
That is not at all the same thing, I said. I am 5 years older than Joanna. I can remember as a child the big, white, shabby, untidy house we had with the fields running down to the river. I can remember creeping under the nets of raspberry canes unseen by the gardener, and the smell of white dust in the stable yard, and an orange cat crossing it, and the sound of horse hooves kicking something in the stables. But when I was 7, and Joanna 2, we went to live in London with an aunt, and thereafter our Christmas and Easter holidays were spent there with pantomimes and theatres and cinemas and excursions to Kensington Gardens with boats, and later to skating rinks. In August, we were taken to an hotel by the seaside somewhere. Reflecting on this, I said thoughtfully to Joanna, and with a feeling of compunction as I realised what a selfish, self-centred invalid I had become, "This is going to be pretty frightful for you, I'm afraid. You'll miss everything so. For Joanna is very pretty and very gay, and she likes dancing and cocktails and love affairs and rushing about in high-powered cars." Joanna laughed and said she didn't mind at all. "As a matter of fact, I'm glad to get away from it all. I really was fed up with the whole crowd, and although you won't be sympathetic, I was really very cut up about Paul. It'll take me a long time to get over it." I was sceptical over this. Joanna's love affairs always run the same course. She has a mad infatuation for some completely spineless young man who is a misunderstood genius. She listens to his endless complaints and works like anything to get him recognition. Then, when he is ungrateful, she is deeply wounded and says her heart is broken, until the next gloomy young man comes along, which is usually about 3 weeks later. So I did not take Joanna's broken heart very seriously. but I did see that living in the country was like a new game to my attractive sister. At any rate, she said, I look all right, don't I? I studied her critically and was not able to agree. Joanna was dressed by Mirotin for le sport. That is to say, she was wearing a skirt of outrageous and preposterous checks. It was skin-tight, and on her upper half she had a ridiculous little short-sleeved jersey with a Tyrolean effect. She had sheer silk stockings and some irreproachable but brand-new brogues. No, I said, you're all wrong. You ought to be wearing a very old tweed skirt, preferably of dirty green or faded brown. You'd wear a nice cashmere jumper matching it, and perhaps a cardigan coat, and you'd have a felt hat and thick stockings and old shoes. Then, and only then, you'd sink into the background of Limstock High Street, and not stand out as you do at present. I added, your face is all wrong, too. What's wrong with that? I've got on my country tan makeup number two. Exactly, I said. If you lived in Limstock, you would have on just a little powder to take the shine off your nose and possibly a soupçon of lipstick, not very well applied, and you would almost certainly be wearing all your eyebrows instead of only a quarter of them. Joanna gurgled and seemed much amused. Do you think they'll think I'm awful? She said. No, I said. Just queer. Joanna had resumed her study of the cards left by our callers. Only the vicar's wife had been so fortunate, or possibly unfortunate, as to catch Joanna at home. Joanna murmured, It's rather like happy families, isn't it? Mrs. Legal, the lawyer's wife, Miss Dose, the doctor's daughter, etc. She added with enthusiasm, I do think this is a nice place, Jerry. So sweet and funny and old world. You just can't think of anything nasty happening here, can you? And although I knew what she said was really nonsense, I agreed with her. In a place like Limstock, nothing nasty could happen. It is odd to think that it was just a week later that we got the first letter. I see that I have begun badly. I have given no description of Limstock, and without understanding what Limstock is like, it is impossible to understand my story. To begin with, Limstock has its roots in the past. Somewhere, about the time of the Norman Conquest, Limstock was a place of importance. That importance was chiefly ecclesiastical. Limstock had a priory, and it had a long succession of ambitious and powerful priors. Lords and barons in the surrounding countryside made themselves right with heaven by leaving certain of their lands to the priory. Limstock Priory waxed rich and important, and was a power in the land for many centuries. In due course, however, Henry VIII caused it to share the fate of its contemporaries. From then on, a castle dominated the town. It was still important. It had rights and privileges and wealth. And then, somewhere in 1700 and something, the tide of progress swept Limstock into a backwater. The castle crumbled, neither railways nor main roads came near Limstock. It turned into a little provincial market town, unimportant and forgotten, with a sweep of moorland rising behind it, and placid farms and fields ringing it round. A market was held there once a week, on which day one was apt to encounter cattle in the lanes and roads. It had a small race meeting twice a year, which only the most obscure horses attended. It had a charming high street, with dignified houses set flat back, looking slightly incongruous with their ground-floor windows displaying buns or vegetables or fruit. It had a long, straggling draper's shop, a large and portentous ironmonger's, a pretentious post office, and a row of straggly, indeterminate shops, two rival butchers and an international stores. It had a doctor, a firm of solicitors, Messrs. Galbraith, Galbraith and Symington, a beautiful and unexpectedly large church dating from 1420, with some Saxon remains incorporated in it, a new and hideous school, and two pubs. Such was Limstock, and urged on by Emily Barton, anybody who was anybody came to call upon us, and in due course Joanna, having bought a pair of gloves and assumed a velvet beret rather the worse for wear, sallied forth to return them. To us, it was all quite novel and entertaining. We were not there for life. It was, for us, an interlude. I prepared to obey my doctor's instructions, and get interested in my neighbours. Joanna and I found it all great fun. I remembered, I suppose, Marcus Kent's instructions to enjoy the local scandals. I certainly didn't suspect how these scandals were going to be introduced to my notice. The odd part of it was that the letter, when it came, amused us more than anything else. It arrived, I remember, at breakfast. I turned it over in the idle way one does when time goes slowly and every event must be spun out to its full extent. It was, I saw, a local letter with a typewritten address. I opened it before the two with London postmarks, since one of them was a bill, and the other from a rather tiresome cousin. Inside, printed words and letters had been cut out and gummed to a sheet of paper. For a minute or two I stared at the words without taking them in. Then I gasped. Joanna, who was frowning over some bills, looked up. "Hello," she said, "what is it? You look quite startled." The letter, using terms of the coarsest character, expressed the writer's opinion that Joanna and I were not brother and sister. "It's a particularly foul, anonymous letter," I said. I was still suffering from shock. Somehow one didn't expect that kind of thing in the placid backwater of Limstock. Joanna at once displayed lively interest. "No. What does it say?" In novels, I have noticed, anonymous letters of a foul and disgusting character are never shown, if possible, to women. It is implied that women must at all costs be shielded from the shock it might give their delicate nervous systems. I am sorry to say it never occurred to me not to show the letter to Joanna. I handed it to her at once. She vindicated my belief in her toughness by displaying no emotion but that of amusement. "What an awful bit of dirt. I've always heard about anonymous letters, but I've never seen one before. Are they always like this?" "I can't tell you," I said. "It's my first experience, too." Joanna began to giggle. "You must have been right about my makeup, Jerry. I suppose they think I must be an abandoned female." "That," I said, "coupled with the fact that our father was a tall, dark, lantern-jawed man, and our mother a fair-haired, blue-eyed little creature, and that I take after him, and you take after her." Joanna nodded thoughtfully. "Yes, we're not a bit alike. Nobody would take us for brother and sister." "Somebody certainly hasn't," I said with feeling. Joanna said she thought it was frightfully funny. She dangled the letter thoughtfully by one corner and asked what we were to do with it. "The correct procedure, I believe," I said, "is to drop it into the fire with a sharp exclamation of disgust." I suited the action to the word, and Joanna applauded. "You did that beautifully," she added. "You ought to have been on the stage. It's lucky we still have fires, isn't it?" "The waste paper basket would have been much less dramatic," I agreed. "I could, of course, have set light to it with a match and slowly watched it burn. Or watched it slowly burn." "Things never burn when you want them to," said Joanna. "They go out. You'd probably have had to strike match after match." She got up and went towards the window. Then, standing there, she turned her head sharply. "I wonder," she said, "who wrote it?" "We're never likely to know," I said. "No, I suppose not." She was silent a moment, and then said, "I don't know when I come to think of it that it is so funny after all. You know, I thought they liked us down here." "So they do," I said. "This is just some half-crazy brain on the borderline."
"I suppose so."
"Ugh, nasty." As she went out into the sunshine, I thought to myself as I smoked my after-breakfast cigarette that she was quite right. It was nasty. Someone resented our coming here. Someone resented Joanna's bright, young, sophisticated beauty. Somebody wanted to hurt. To take it with a laugh was perhaps the best way, but deep down, it wasn't funny. Dr. Griffith came that morning. I had fixed up for him to give me a weekly overhaul. I liked Owen Griffith. He was dark, ungainly, with awkward ways of moving and deft, very gentle hands. He had a jerky way of talking and was rather shy. He reported progress to be encouraging. Then he added, "You're feeling all right, aren't you? Is it my fancy, or are you a bit under the weather this morning? Not really, I said. A particularly scurrilous anonymous letter arrived with the morning coffee, and has left rather a nasty taste in the mouth. He dropped his bag on the floor. His thin, dark face was excited. Do you mean to say that you've had one of them? I was interested. They've been going about, then? Yes, for some time. Oh, I said, I see. I was under the impression that our presence as strangers was resented here. No, no, it's nothing to do with that, it's just... He paused and then asked, What did it say? At least... He turned suddenly red and embarrassed. Perhaps I oughtn't to ask. I'll tell you with pleasure, I said. It just said that the fancy tart I'd brought down with me wasn't my sister. Not half. And that, I may say, is a bowdlerized version. His dark face flushed angrily. How damnable. Your sister didn't... She's not upset, I hope. Joanna, I said, looks a little like the angel off the top of the Christmas tree, but she's eminently modern and quite tough. She found it highly entertaining. Such things haven't come her way before. I should hope not, indeed, said Griffith warmly. And anyway, I said firmly, that's the best way to take it, I think. As something utterly ridiculous. Yes, said Owen Griffith. Only... Quite so, I said. Only is the word. The trouble is, he said, that this sort of thing, once it starts, grows. So I should imagine. It's pathological, of course. I nodded. Any idea who's behind it? I asked. No, I wish I had. You see, the anonymous letter pest arises from one of two causes. Either it's particular, directed at one particular person or set of people, that is to say it's motivated. It's someone who's got a definite grudge, or thinks they have, and who chooses a particularly nasty and underhand way of working it off. It's mean and disgusting, but it's not necessarily crazy, and it's usually fairly easy to trace the writer, a discharged servant, a jealous woman, and so on. But if it's general and not particular, then it's more serious. The letters are sent indiscriminately and serve the purpose of working off some frustration in the writer's mind. As I say, it's definitely pathological. And the craze grows. In the end, of course, you track down the person in question. It's often someone extremely unlikely. And that's that. There was a bad outburst of the kind over the other side of the county last year. Turned out to be the head of the millinery department in a big draper's establishment. Quiet, refined woman. Had been there for years. I remember something of the same kind in my last practice up north, but that turned out to be purely personal spite. Still, as I say, I've seen something of this kind of thing, and quite frankly, it frightens me. Has it been going on long? I asked. I don't think so. Hard to say, of course, because people who get these letters don't go around advertising the fact. They put them in the fire. He paused. I've had one myself. Symington, the solicitor, he's had one. And one or two of my poorer patients have told me about them. All much the same sort of thing. Oh, yes. A definite harping on the sex theme. That's always a feature. He grinned. Symington was accused of illicit relations with his lady clerk. Poor old Miss Ginch, who's 40 at least, with pince-nez and teeth like a rabbit. Symington took it straight to the police. My letters accused me of violating professional decorum with my lady patients, stressing the details. They're all quite childish and absurd, but horribly venomous. His face changed, grew grave. But all the same, I'm afraid. These things can be dangerous, you know. I suppose they can. You see, he said, crude, childish spite though it is, sooner or later one of these letters will hit the mark, and then... God knows what may happen. I'm afraid, too, of the effect upon the slow, suspicious, uneducated mind. If they see a thing written, they believe it's true. All sorts of complications may arise. It was an illiterate sort of letter, I said thoughtfully, written by somebody practically illiterate, I should say. Was it? Said Owen, and went away. Thinking it over afterwards, I found that, was it, rather disturbing. Chapter 2. I'm not going to pretend that the arrival of our anonymous letter did not leave a nasty taste in the mouth. It did. At the same time, it soon passed out of my mind. I did not, you see, at that point, take it seriously. I think I remember saying to myself that these things probably happen fairly often in out-of-the-way villages. Some hysterical woman with a taste for dramatizing herself was probably at the bottom of it. Anyway, if the letters were as childish and silly as the one we had got, they couldn't do much harm. The next incident, if I may put it so, occurred about a week later when Partridge, her lips set tightly together, informed me that Beatrice, the Daily Help, would not be coming today. "I gather, sir," said Partridge, "that the girl has been upset." I was not very sure what Partridge was implying, but I diagnosed, wrongly, some stomachic trouble to which Partridge was too delicate to allude more directly. I said I was sorry, and hoped she would soon be better. "The girl is perfectly well, sir," said Partridge. "She's upset in her feelings." "Oh," I said rather doubtfully. "Owing," went on Partridge, "to a letter she has received, making, I understand, insinuations." The grimness of Partridge's eye, coupled with the obvious capital I of insinuations, made me apprehensive that the insinuations were concerned with me. Since I would hardly have recognised Beatrice by sight if I'd met her in the town, so unaware of her had I been, I felt a not unnatural annoyance. An invalid hobbling about on two sticks is hardly cast for the role of deceiver of village girls. I said irritably, "What nonsense!" "My very word, sir, to the girl's mother," said Partridge. "Goings on in this house," I said to her, "there never have been and never will be while I'm in charge. As to Beatrice," I said, "girls are different nowadays, and as to goings on elsewhere, I can say nothing. But the truth is, sir, that Beatrice's friend from the garage, as she walks out with, got one of them nasty letters too, and he isn't acting reasonable at all." "I've never heard anything so preposterous in my life," I said angrily. "It's my opinion, sir," said Partridge, "that we're well rid of the girl. What I say is, she wouldn't take on so if there wasn't something she didn't want found out. No smoke without fire, that's what I say." I had no idea how horribly tired I was going to get of that particular phrase. That morning, by way of adventure, I was to walk down to the village. Joanna and I always called it the village, though technically we were incorrect, and Limstock would have been annoyed to hear us. The sun was shining, the air was cool and crisp, with the sweetness of spring in it. I assembled my sticks and started off, firmly refusing to permit Joanna to accompany me. "No," I said, "I will not have a guardian angel teetering along beside me and uttering encouraging chirrups. A man travels fastest who travels alone, remember. I have much business to transact. I shall go to Galbraith, Galbraith and Symington and sign that transfer of shares. I shall call in at the baker's and complain about the current loaf. And I shall return that book we borrowed. I have to go to the bank, too. Let me away, woman. The morning is all too short." It was arranged that Joanna should pick me up with the car and drive me back up the hill in time for lunch. "That ought to give you time to pass the time of day with everyone in Limstock." "I have no doubt," I said, "that I shall have seen anybody who is anybody by then." For morning in the High Street was a kind of rendezvous for shoppers, when news was exchanged. I did not, after all, walk down to the town unaccompanied. I'd gone about 200 yards when I heard a bicycle bell behind me, then a scrunching of brakes, and then Megan Hunter more or less fell off her machine at my feet. "Hello," she said breathlessly as she rose and dusted herself off. I rather liked Megan, and always felt oddly sorry for her. She was Symington the lawyer's stepdaughter, Mrs. Symington's daughter by a first marriage. Nobody talked much about Mr. or Captain Hunter, and I gathered that he was considered best forgotten. He was reported to have treated Mrs. Symington very badly. She had divorced him a year or two after the marriage. She was a woman with means of her own, and had settled down with her little daughter in Limstock to forget, and had eventually married the only eligible bachelor in the place, Richard Symington. There were two boys of the second marriage to whom their parents were devoted, and I fancy that Megan sometimes felt odd man out in the establishment. She certainly did not resemble her mother, who was a small, anemic woman, fadedly pretty, who talked in a thin, melancholy voice of servant difficulties and her health. Megan was a tall, awkward girl, and although she was actually 20, she looked more like a schoolgirlish 16. She had a shock of untidy brown hair, hazel-green eyes, a thin, bony face, and an unexpected, charming, one-sided smile. Her clothes were drab and unattractive, and she usually had on lisle thread stockings with holes in them. She looked, I decided this morning, much more like a horse than a human being. In fact, she would have been a very nice horse, with a little grooming. She spoke, as usual, in a kind of breathless rush. "I've been up to the farm, you know, Lasher's, to see if they've got any duck's eggs. They've got an awfully nice lot of little pigs. Sweet! Do you like pigs? I even like the smell."
"Well-kept pigs shouldn't smell," I said.
"Shouldn't they? They all do round here. Are you walking down to the town? I saw you were alone, so I thought I'd stop and walk with you, only I stopped rather suddenly."
"You've torn your stocking," I said.
Megan looked rather ruefully at her right leg.
"So I have. But it's got two holes already, so it doesn't matter very much, does it?"
"Don't you ever mend your stockings, Megan?"
"Rather, when Mummy catches me. But she doesn't notice awfully what I do, so it's lucky in a way, isn't it?"
"You don't seem to realise you're grown up," I said.
"You mean I ought to be more like your sister, all dulled up?"
I rather resented this description of Joanna. "She looks clean and tidy and pleasing to the eye," I said.
"She's awfully pretty," said Megan. "She isn't a bit like you, is she?"
"Why not?"
"Brothers and sisters aren't always alike."
"No, of course. I'm not very like Brian or Colin. And Brian and Colin aren't like each other." She paused and said,
"It's very rum, isn't it?"
"What is?" Megan replied briefly,
"Families."
I said thoughtfully,
"I suppose they are."
I wondered just what was passing in her mind. We walked on in silence for a moment or two. Then Megan said in a rather shy voice,
"You fly, don't you?"
"Yes."
"That's how you got hurt?"
"Yes, I crashed."
Megan said, "Nobody down here flies."
"No," I said. "I suppose not."
"Would you like to fly, Megan?"
"Me?"
Megan seemed surprised.
"Goodness, no. I should be sick. I'm sick in a train, even."
She paused and then asked with that directness which only a child usually displays,
"Will you get all right and be able to fly again? Or will you always be a bit of a crock?"
"My doctor says I shall be quite all right."
"Yes, but is he the kind of man who tells lies?"
"I don't think so," I replied. "In fact, I'm quite sure of it. I trust him."
"That's all right, then. But a lot of people do tell lies."
I accepted this undeniable statement of fact in silence. Megan said in a detached, judicial kind of way,
"I'm glad. I was afraid you looked bad-tempered because you were crocked up for life. But if it's just natural, it's different."
"I'm not bad-tempered," I said coldly.
"Well, irritable, then."
"I'm irritable because I'm in a hurry to get fit again. And these things can't be hurried."
"Then why fuss?"
I began to laugh. "My dear girl, aren't you ever in a hurry for things to happen?"
Megan considered the question. She said,
"No. Why should I be? There's nothing to be in a hurry about. Nothing ever happens."
I was struck by something forlorn in the words. I said gently, "What do you do with yourself down here?" She shrugged her shoulders.
"What is there to do?"
"Haven't you got any hobbies? Do you play games? Have you got friends round about?"
"I'm stupid at games, and I don't like them much. There aren't many girls round here, and the ones there are I don't like. They think I'm awful."
"Nonsense, why should they?"
Megan shook her head.
"Didn't you go to school at all?"
"Yes, I came back a year ago."
"Did you enjoy school?"
"Wasn't bad. They taught you things in an awfully silly way, though."
"How do you mean?"
"Well, just bits and pieces. Chopping and changing from one thing to the other. It was a cheap school, you know, and the teachers weren't very good.
They could never answer questions properly.
Very few teachers can, I said.
Why not?
They ought to. I agreed.
Of course, I'm pretty stupid, said Megan, and such a lot of things seem to me such rot. History, for instance. Why, it's quite different out of different books.
That is its real interest, I said.
And grammar, went on Megan, and silly compositions, and all the blathering stuff Shelley wrote, twittering on about skylarks, and Wordsworth going all potty over some silly daffodils, and Shakespeare.
What's wrong with Shakespeare? I inquired with interest.
Twisting himself up to say things in such a difficult way that you can't get at what he means. Still, I like some Shakespeare.
He would be gratified to know that, I'm sure, I said. Megan suspected no sarcasm. She said, her face lighting up,
I like Goneril and Regan, for instance.
Why these two?
Oh, I don't know. They're satisfactory, somehow. Why do you think they were like that?
Like what?
Like they were. I mean, something must have made them like that.
For the first time, I wondered. I had always accepted Lear's elder daughters as two nasty bits of goods, and had let it go at that. But Megan's demand for a first cause interested me. I'll think about it, I said.
Oh, it doesn't really matter. I just wondered. Anyway, it's only English literature, isn't it?
Quite, quite. Wasn't there any subject you enjoyed?
Only maths.
Maths? I said, rather surprised.
Megan's face had lit up. I loved maths, but it wasn't awfully well taught. I'd like to be taught maths really well. It's heavenly. I think there's something heavenly about numbers anyway, don't you?
I've never felt it, I said truthfully.
We were now entering the high street. Megan said sharply, Here's Miss Griffith. Hateful woman.
Don't you like her?
I loathe her. She's always had me to join her foul guides. I hate guides. Why dress yourself up and go about in clumps and put badges on yourself for something you haven't really learnt to do properly? I think it's all rot.
On the whole, I rather agreed with Megan. But Miss Griffith had descended on us before I could voice my assent. The doctor's sister, who rejoined in the singularly inappropriate name of Amy, had all the positive assurance that her brother lacked. She was a handsome woman in a masculine, weather-beaten way, with a deep, hearty voice. "Hello, you two," she bayed at us. "Gorgeous morning, isn't it? Megan, you're just the person I wanted to see. I want some help addressing envelopes for the Conservative Association." Megan muttered something elusive, propped up her bicycle against the curb, and dived in a purposeful way into the international stores. "Extraordinary child," said Miss Griffith, looking after her. "Bony lazy. Spends her time mooning about." Must be a great trial to poor Mrs. Symington. I know her mother's tried more than once to get her to take up something. Shorthand typing, you know, or cookery, or keeping Angora rabbits. She needs an interest in life. I thought that was probably true, but felt that in Megan's place I should have withstood firmly any of Amy Griffith's suggestions for the simple reason that her aggressive personality would have put my back up. I don't believe in idleness, went on Miss Griffith. And certainly not for young people. It's not as though Megan was pretty or attractive or anything like that. Sometimes I think the girl's half-witted. Great disappointment to her mother. The father, you know, she lowered her voice slightly, was definitely a wrong'un. Afraid the child takes after him. Painful for her mother. Oh, well, takes all sorts to make a world. That's what I say. Fortunately, I responded. Amy Griffith gave a jolly laugh.
Yes, wouldn't do if we were all made to one pattern. But I don't like to see anyone not getting all they can out of life. I enjoy life myself, and I want everyone to enjoy it too. People say to me, you must be bored to death, living down there in the country all the year round. Not a bit of it, I say. I'm always busy, always happy. There's always something going on in the country. My time's taken up, what with my guides and the institute and various committees. To say nothing of looking after Owen.
At this minute, Miss Griffith saw an acquaintance on the other side of the street, and uttering a bay of recognition, she leapt across the road, leaving me free to pursue my course to the bank. I always found Miss Griffith rather overwhelming, though I admired her energy and vitality.
and it was pleasant to see the beaming contentment with her lot in life which she always displayed, and which was a pleasant contrast to the subdued complaining murmurs of so many women. My business at the bank transacted satisfactorily. I went on to the offices of Messrs. Galbraith, Galbraith and Symington. I don't know if there were any Galbraiths extant. I never saw any. I was shown into Richard Symington's inner office, which had the agreeable mustiness of a long-established legal firm. Vast numbers of deed boxes, labelled Lady Hope, Sir Everard Carr, William Yatesby Hawes, Esquire, deceased, etc., gave the required atmosphere of decorous county families and legitimate long-established business. Studying Mr. Symington as he bent over the documents I had brought, it occurred to me that if Mrs. Symington had encountered disaster in her first marriage, she had certainly played safe in her second. Richard Symington was the acme of calm respectability, the sort of man who would never give his wife a moment's anxiety. A long neck with a pronounced Adam's apple, a slightly cadaverous face and a long, thin nose. A kindly man, no doubt, a good husband and father, but not one to set the pulses madly racing. Presently Mr. Symington began to speak. He spoke clearly and slowly, delivering himself of much good sense and shrewd acumen. We settled the matter in hand, and I rose to go, remarking as I did so, "I walked down the hill with your stepdaughter." For a moment Mr. Symington looked as though he did not know who his stepdaughter was. Then he smiled.
"Oh, yes, of course, Megan. She, has been back from school some time. We're thinking about finding her something to do. Yes, to do. But of course she's very young still, and backward for her age, so they say. Yes, so they tell me."
I went out. In the outer office was a very old man on a stool writing slowly and laboriously, a small, cheeky-looking boy, and a middle-aged woman with frizzy hair and pince-nez, who was typing with some speed and dash. If this was Miss Ginch, I agreed with Owen Griffith that tender passages between her and her employer were exceedingly unlikely. I went into the baker's and said my piece about the currant loaf. It was received with the exclamation and incredulity proper to the occasion, and a new currant loaf was thrust upon me in replacement. "Fresh from the oven this minute," as its indecent heat pressed against my chest proclaimed to be no less than the truth. I came out of the shop and looked up and down the street, hoping to see Joanna with the car. The walk had tired me a good deal, and it was awkward getting along with my sticks and the currant loaf. But there was no sign of Joanna as yet. Suddenly my eyes were held in glad and incredulous surprise. Along the pavement towards me there came floating a goddess. There is really no other word for it. The perfect features, the crisply curling golden hair, the tall, exquisitely shaped body. And she walked like a goddess, without effort, seeming to swim nearer and nearer. A glorious, an incredible, a breathtaking girl. In my intense excitement, something had to go. What went was the currant loaf. It slipped from my clutches. I made a dive after it and lost my stick, which clattered to the pavement, and I slipped and nearly fell myself. It was the strong arm of the goddess that caught and held me. I began to stammer, "Thanks awfully, I'm frightfully sorry." She had retrieved the currant loaf and handed it to me together with the stick, and then she smiled kindly and said cheerfully, "Don't mention it. No trouble, I assure you." And the magic died completely before the flat, competent voice. A nice, healthy-looking, well-set-up girl. No more. I fell to reflecting what would have happened if the gods had given Helen of Troy exactly those flat accents. How strange that a girl could trouble your inmost soul so long as she kept her mouth shut, and that the moment she spoke the glamour could vanish as though it had never been. I had known the reverse happen, though. I had seen a little sad monkey-faced woman whom no one would turn to look at twice. Then she opened her mouth, and suddenly enchantment had lived and bloomed, and Cleopatra had cast her spell anew. Joanna had drawn up at the curb beside me without my noticing her arrival. She asked if there was anything the matter. "Nothing," I said, pulling myself together. "I was reflecting on Helen of Troy and others." "What a funny place to do it," said Joanna. "You looked most odd, standing there clasping currant bread to your breast with your mouth wide open." "I've had a shock," I said. "I've been transplanted to Ilium and back again." "Do you know who that is?" I added, indicating a retreating back that was swimming gracefully away. Peering after the girl, Joanna said that it was the Symington's nursery governess. "Is that what struck you all of a heap?" she asked. "She's good-looking, but a bit of a wet fish." "I know," I said. "Just a nice, kind girl. And I'd been thinking her Aphrodite." Joanna opened the door of the car, and I got in. "It's funny, isn't it?" she said. "Some people have lots of looks and absolutely no S.A. That girl has. It seems such a pity." I said that if she was a nursery governess, it was probably just as well. Chapter 3. That afternoon, we went to tea with Mr. Pye. Mr. Pye was an extremely ladylike, plump little man, devoted to his petit point chairs, his Dresden shepherdesses, and his collection of bric-a-brac. He lived at Prior's Lodge, in the grounds of which were the ruins of the old priory. Prior's Lodge was certainly a very exquisite house, and under Mr. Pye's loving care it showed to its best advantage. Every piece of furniture was polished and set in the exact place most suited to it. The curtains and cushions were of exquisite tone and colour, and of the most expensive silks. It was hardly a man's house, and it did strike me that to live there would be rather like taking up one's abode in a period room at a museum. Mr. Pye's principal enjoyment in life was taking people round his house. Even those completely insensitive to their surroundings could not escape. Even if you were so hardened as to consider the essentials of living a radio, a cocktail bar, a bath and a bed surrounded by the necessary walls, Mr. Pye did not despair of leading you to better things. His small, plump hands quivered with sensibility as he described his treasures, and his voice rose to a falsetto squeak as he narrated the exciting circumstances under which he had brought his Italian bedstead home from Verona. Joanna and I, being both fond of antiquities and of period furniture, met with approval.
"It is really a pleasure, a great pleasure to have such an acquisition to our little community. The dear good people down here, you know, so painfully bucolic, not to say provincial, they don't know anything. Vandals, absolute vandals. In the inside of their houses, it would make you weep, dear lady. I assure you, it would make you weep. Perhaps it has done so."
Joanna said that she hadn't gone quite as far as that.
"But you see what I mean. They mix things so terribly. I've seen with my own eyes a most delightful little Sheraton piece, delicate, perfect. A collector's piece, absolutely. And next to it a Victorian occasional table, or quite possibly a fumed oak revolving book case. Yes, even that. Fumed oak."
He shuddered, and murmured plaintively,
"Why are people so blind? You agree, I'm sure you agree, that beauty is the only thing worth living for."
Hypnotized by his earnestness, Joanna said, "Yes, yes, that was so."
"Then why," demanded Mr. Pye, "do people surround themselves with ugliness?"
Joanna said it was very odd.
"Odd? It's criminal. That's what I call it, criminal. The excuses they give, they say something is comfortable, or that it is quaint, quaint. Such a horrible word." "The house you have taken," went on Mr. Pye, "Miss Emily Barton's house. Now that is charming, and she has some quite nice pieces, quite nice. One or two of them are really first class. And she has taste, too, although I'm not quite so sure of that as I was. Sometimes, I'm afraid, I think it's really sentiment. She likes to keep things as they were, but not for le bon motif, not because of the resultant harmony, but because it is the way her mother had them."
He transferred his attention to me, and his voice changed. It altered from that of the rapt artist to that of the born gossip.
You didn't know the family at all? No, quite so. Yes, through the house agents. But, my dears, you ought to have known that family. When I came here, the old mother was still alive. An incredible person, quite incredible. A monster, if you know what I mean. Positively a monster. The old-fashioned Victorian monster, devouring her young. Yes, that's what it amounted to. She was monumental, you know. Must have weighed 17 stone. And all the 5 daughters revolved round her. The girls. That's how she always spoke of them, the girls. And the eldest was well over 60 then. Those stupid girls, she used to call them sometimes. Black slaves, that's all they were, fetching and carrying and agreeing with her. 10 o'clock they had to go to bed, and they weren't allowed a fire in their bedroom, and as for asking their own friends to the house, that would have been unheard of. She despised them, you know, for not getting married, and yet so arranged their lives that it was practically impossible for them to meet anybody. I believe Emily, or perhaps it was Agnes, did have some kind of affair with a curate. But his family wasn't good enough, and Mama soon put a stop to that.
It sounds like a novel, said Joanna.
Oh, my dear, it was. And then the dreadful old woman died, but of course it was far too late then. They just went on living there and talking in hushed voices about what poor Mama would have wished. Even repapering her bedroom they felt to be quite sacrilegious. Still, they did enjoy themselves in the parish in a quiet way. But none of them had much stamina, and they just died off one by one. Influenza took off Edith, and Minnie had an operation and didn't recover, and poor Mabel had a stroke. Emily looked after her in the most devoted manner. Really, that poor woman has done nothing but nursing for the last 10 years. A charming creature, don't you think? Like a piece of Dresden. So sad for her having financial anxieties. But, of course, all investments have depreciated.
We feel rather awful being in her house, said Joanna.
No, no, my dear young lady, you mustn't feel that way. Her dear good Florence is devoted to her, and she told me herself how happy she was to have got such nice tenants.
Here Mr. Pye made a little bow.
She told me she thought she had been most fortunate.
The house, I said, has a very soothing atmosphere. Mr. Pye darted a quick glance at me.
Really? You feel that? Now that's very interesting. I wondered, you know. Yes, I wondered.
What do you mean, Mr. Pye? Asked Joanna. Mr. Pye spread out his plump hands.
Nothing, nothing. One wondered, that is all. I do believe in atmosphere, you know. People's thoughts and feelings. They give their impression to the walls and the furniture.
I did not speak for a moment or two. I was looking round me and wondering how I would describe the atmosphere of Prior's Lodge. It seemed to me that the curious thing was that it hadn't any atmosphere. That was really very remarkable. I reflected on this point so long that I heard nothing of the conversation going on between Joanna and her host. I was recalled to myself, however, by hearing Joanna uttering farewell preliminaries. I came out of my dream and added my quota. We all went out into the hall. As we came towards the front door, a letter came through the box and fell on the mat.
"Afternoon post," murmured Mr. Pye as he picked it up. "Now, my dear young people, you will come again, won't you? Such a pleasure to meet some broader minds, if you understand me. Someone with an appreciation of art. Really, you know, these dear good people down here, if you mention the ballet, it conveys to them pirouetting toes and tulle skirts and old gentlemen with opera glasses in the naughty 90s. It does indeed. 50 years behind the times. That's what I put them down as. A wonderful country, England. It has pockets. Limstock is one of them. Interesting from a collector's point of view. I always feel I have voluntarily put myself under a glass shade when I'm here. The peaceful backwater where nothing ever happens.
Shaking hands with us twice over, he helped me with exaggerated care into the car. Joanna took the wheel. She negotiated with some care the circular sweep round a plot of unblemished grass. Then, with a straight drive ahead, she raised a hand to wave goodbye to our host, where he stood on the steps of the house. I leaned forward to do the same, but our gesture of farewell went unheeded. Mr. Pye had opened his mail. He was standing staring down at the open sheet in his hand.
End of disc 1.